Scripture reading this morning is from the book of Genesis, chapter 13, verses 8 through 12. I'll be reading from the New American Standard Version. Genesis 13, 8 through 12. So Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right, or if to the right, then I will go to the left." Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom.
Good morning. It's good to be with you. We do have several who are visiting with us. We're glad that you're with us and that we all have the privilege to join together and to worship God and to be an encouragement to one another. And I'm grateful for the privilege to be together and to accomplish that. And I pray that God will be glorified as a result of the time that we spend together this morning. We've been going through our theme this year on written for our learning, which taking us back to the Old Testament to see some of the value of the things that we find in the Old Testament. And I want to consider an event, the event that we just read there in Genesis chapter 13. It might just seem like a minute detail there, but I think that's a very profound detail, and I think it's one that has significant ramifications on the trajectory of Lot's life, particularly those of his family. And so we find, as we just read a moment ago, Lot and Abraham make the decision to separate because there's quarreling between his herdsmen and Lot's herdsmen, and they want to separate lest they, you know, because there's plenty of room here, we don't need to be right here together. And so Abraham, of course, gives Lot the choice which direction he wants to go, and Lot chooses the valley and pitches his tent in the direction of Sodom. And so I want to think about that decision and then some of the direction or some of the impacts that decision had on his life. And then what we can learn from that from our own lives, how we can avoid pitching our own tents toward Sodom and make our decisions with God as our focus. And so the text again told us that Abraham and Lot had the flocks that could not sustain both together. The land could not sustain them, so they separate. And it says that in verse 10, that Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before Yahweh had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of Yahweh, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. And so he describes the well-watered nature of this land. And if you're trying to raise a flock, if you got a herd with you that you're carrying with you, that well-watered plain might seem like a good place because there's plenty of grass for them to graze upon, right? And yet, it does tell us in verse 10 that God had not yet destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. We're going to see that in chapter 19, and we'll go to that chapter in just a moment. But we find in verse 13, it tells us the men of Sodom were evil and sinners, exceedingly so against Yahweh. And so that underscores the statement that was just made in verse 12, where Lot pitches his tent or moves his tent as far as Sodom. And the text makes sure to let us know that the men of Sodom are exceedingly wicked. That's why in chapter 19 they're going to be destroyed. Now, the text does not explicitly state that Lot knows this, but I think it seems to be implied that he had an idea of the wickedness of the area. I think it's akin to a reputation that Sodom would have had, much like Las Vegas today. That's not a very good reputation, right? If somebody says, oh, I'm going to Las Vegas, there's not a whole lot of good things that you can be doing there, right? And yet, it's a reputation. It's called Sin City for a reason. That seems to be the reputation that Sodom has, and it seems clear that Lot probably knew a little bit about where he was going. And yet, despite that, he still chooses to make his decision based upon material appearances, based upon the well-watered plains that he looked upon and sees. And it does tell us that he lives in the cities, and he pitched his tent toward Sodom. And I want to suggest that this is a decision of moral compromise. Lot has not moved into Sodom yet. But I think we should recognize this as a moment of moral compromise, because he's moving closer and closer to the city, and he's putting himself and his family directly in the path of its influence. And we're going to see the consequences of that in just a moment. But I do think that this was a moment of moral compromise. We can make excuses all we want. Well, I'm not living in the city yet. Well, eventually you will be. Or, you know, the city needs good influences. Well, yes, it does. But we make very poor decisions sometimes when we try and rationalize things without recognizing the gravity of that situation. Again, the description, the men of Sodom were evil and sinners exceedingly so. There's only so much you can do. And I think this is a case where Lot, because of the well-watered plains and the way that the city looked good to his eyes, or the valley looked good to his eyes, he moved himself close to the wickedness, thinking that, you know, it's a good place to live. This would be the beginning of a slippery slope that had dramatic consequences upon Lot and his family. It's not an innocent decision. And we'll talk about that a little bit later as we come back. But I want to notice real quickly the progression that Lot takes after making this choice to go into this valley. Verse 10, he saw the valley. He looked toward Sodom, in verse 10 there. In verse 13, he pitched his tent toward Sodom. In chapter 14 and verse 12, it says that he that would be 19 and verse 12, he lived, or 14 and verse 12, he lived in Sodom at that point. He was now living in Sodom. In chapter 19 and verse 1, it tells us that he sat in the gate of Sodom. And so you see a progression there. You remember we see in Psalm 1, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of the scornful. There's a digression. It's not progression. It's a digression there as you're growing further and further down that path. And that's the way that Lot goes here. We're going to temper that in just a second in 2 Peter chapter 2. But we see a progression taking place. He's getting closer and closer and closer and closer to this city that God has described as being exceedingly wicked. And so I do want to note before we move on that we can probably all agree, and I hope that we can agree, that this is a very poor decision that Lot makes. And we're going to see the consequences of that in just a moment to underscore the depth of how poor this decision was. But I do want to temper that with what we do find in the New Testament, 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 7, because it does describe Lot as being righteous. 2 Peter 2 and verse 7 says, if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of principled men. And so he does acknowledge in the New Testament, God acknowledges the righteousness of Lot. But that doesn't mean that Lot made a solid decision here. And so despite his righteousness and despite the fact that he was tormented or oppressed by the unrighteousness around him, he did choose to place himself in the midst of that unrighteousness, and he was not free from the consequences of that. So what are the consequences of Lot's choice? If we back up to Genesis chapter 14, we find in the very next chapter, after reading about him moving his tent toward Sodom, it says that there's these four kings of the valley. They come to battle against the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, and three other kings. And there's this big war that takes place. And in verse 12 of chapter 14, it says, they also took Lot, Abraham's nephew, and his possessions. So Sodom and Gomorrah are looted after they've been defeated. And among that capture, Lot was taken captive. And so Abraham, in the rest of the chapter, or in the verses that follow, Abraham hears of this, and he goes and he rescues Lot from this captivity. And then we find that occasion with Melchizedek, and we'll talk about him tonight in our Q&A lesson. But we find one of the consequences is he puts himself essentially in harm's way because this battle takes place. And now Lot is a captive and has to be rescued by his I believe it was his uncle, Abraham. Now that seems to be a rather minor consequence, but if you want to look at a greater consequence and more significant consequences of Lot's decision here, we can look at chapter 19, and this is the case where the city of Sodom and Gomorrah is destroyed. And so Lot had moved into Sodom, and it says that Lot saw them, or he was sitting in the gate of Sodom, which is a place of a position of local influence and leadership, which we can say we need godly leaders. But it says these two men that Abraham had dealt with in the previous chapter, these two angels that Abraham had talked with in the previous chapter, had come to Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot sees them, and in an effort to insulate or protect them from the wickedness of the city, brings them to his house. And then verses 6 through 8, the men of the city had come and were pounding on the door demanding these men so essentially they could have relations with them. And it says Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them what is good in your eyes. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under my shelter, the shelter of my roof." He made efforts to protect them from his wickedness, but he offers his own daughters. I don't think that that's a very solid choice. I mean, that does seem like he's father of the year on this occasion, offering his own daughters to be really raped by this horde of men. And yet, that's exactly what he's doing. I think we can see that he puts himself in a position like this, and it affects his judgment in some way. And then in verse 14, it affects his influence with his own family, because in verse 14, Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, and this is after he was told that the city was going to be destroyed and to flee. He went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, said, "Get up, get out of this place, for Yahweh will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. He had no influence upon them, and so they're going to stay behind and be destroyed. And if it's not bad enough, he's told to leave the city, verse 15, "Get up, take your wife, your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." In verse 16, he hesitated. We might relate to that a little bit. I mean, here, after all, this is his children that are being left behind, that are going to be carried away in this destruction, and yet he hesitates when he's told to leave. But after he's told to leave, in verse 17, it says, "Escape for your life and do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, lest you be swept away." And then in verse 26, his wife from behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. Now, if you were to ask Lot, as he's looking on this valley when Abraham is giving him this choice, if you were to ask Lot right then and there, "I want you to recognize that making this decision is going to cost you your wife," do you think he would have made that choice? It goes further than that. That's not even the end. In verses 30 through 38, his two daughters who escape with him, they decide that we don't have any man here to build a family with and carry on our father's lineage, and so we're going to act shamefully with our own father. I'm not going to read it because of the grotesqueness of it, but his daughters act shamefully, and you could take that even further. If he's looking at this decision when he makes it, and you told him that you're going to lose your wife, and you're also going to have your daughters act in a shameful manner and create the nations that would become thorns in the side of God's people, are you still going to make that choice? And I know we might think, well, how could he have known? He never knew what these consequences would be. That's exactly right. He didn't know what the consequences would be. But that does not change the fact that he made a decision from one perspective that led to complete and total ruin in many different other areas of his life. Some of these consequences likely would have been avoided had Lot made wiser decisions. Now, if he had made that choice to go to the valley and said, okay, we're going to go into this valley and we're going to stay as far away from Sodom and Gomorrah as we can, maybe it might have turned out different. But as it is, he got as close as he could to Sodom and went and lived inside of Sodom and subjected his family to the influence of Sodom, and the results were disastrous. The results were horrific, catastrophic. And so I want to think about some of the ways in which we can pitch our tents toward Sodom. One of the ways that we can make decisions that we might think are not that big of a deal, but can result in disastrous consequences. One of the first things that comes to mind is the idea of media and entertainment. We watch and we listen to entertainment that regularly celebrates and normalizes sin, whether it's adultery or greed or violence or other kind of sexual immorality, or it's chock full of bad language. And we want to justify that by saying, I know that's wrong, but I'm not actually doing it myself. The problem is, it causes you to gradually lose your sensitivity to it. And that, in and of itself, is a problem. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 19, and I'll begin in verse 17, in this section, Paul urges the Ephesian Christians to no longer walk as the Gentiles walk. And when he talks about Gentiles there, he's using that in a term accommodatively to describe those who are outside of Christ. Not that all Gentiles are out of Christ, but that's just kind of those who are outside of Christ is generally what he means there. Okay, so no longer walk as the Gentiles walk. How do they walk? In the futility of their minds, being darkened in their mind, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them and because of the hardness of their heart. And they, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. Some of your versions will say, who being past feeling. You think about a callous, if you're working, particularly like you've got a shovel and you're just really working hard, you're going to feel the sore spot on your hands right here, right? But then the more you do it, those spots start to harden. And they harden to the point that you can work all day long and it doesn't hurt anymore. It's not sore any longer. You've developed a callous. You ever see somebody's feet who wear sandals all the time and then their feet are just so rough? It's because they've developed calluses on their feet. That's a sense to protect them, to keep them from being hurt as they walk around. But the very point of a callus is it's lost its sensitivity. In some ways, that's a good thing, because if I'm out working all day in the field, not having my hand hurt all the time can be a good thing. When it comes to our conscience, that is never a good thing. And when we subject ourselves to the unrighteousness around us and in the movies and the entertainment and the books and the music and all those other things that we listen to and consume, we fool ourselves if we think that in some way that's not affecting us. When's the last time you saw a movie where there was a scene where fornication was about to take place and you were just like, oh, let's turn that off? Or, well, you know, that's just Hollywood. I heard a lesson years ago where a fellow was describing his dad and what he or his father-in-law and what he witnessed in his father-in-law as he was about to die. And kind of the idea of live like you're dying. And he said his father-in-law used to love Western movies, and he was real sick, not feeling well with cancer, with his cancer, and they put one of those Western movies on. And he's sitting there watching this movie, and all of a sudden this scene comes on where they're about to commit fornication, and he turned that off, turned that off, and asked that they come in and sing hymns with him for a while. And the reality was that he recognized that he was close to eternity, that he was about to cross from this life to the next and to stand before his Creator. And he didn't want that wickedness in his heart as he goes to stand before God. And yet, well, I'm not partaking of it. I think we need to think more about what kind of things we're feeding our minds, because we're becoming desensitized to it, and we're opening the door for sin to open up and take over our hearts. Notice again in verse 19 of Ephesians 4, having become callous, having given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. Not every sin starts with just jumping head in, head first in, into it. Sometimes we get right up close to it, we pitch our tent as far as Sodom, and then we say, well, maybe that's not so bad. Let me buy a house in Sodom. And then all of a sudden, the influence is overtaking us in ways that we never thought were possible. You may not be in Sodom, but your heart is being shaped by it. And that's why it's so important that we be careful what we feed our minds, because we don't want our heart to be shaped by Sodom. We saw what happened to Sodom, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And if our hearts are shaped by Sodom, we're going to be destroyed ourselves. And then in relationships that normalize compromise, whether it's a close friendship that pulls us away from Christ, I've heard it said before that you are the sum of the five people that are closest to you. And I want to ask a very pointed question in relation to that. Are those five people that are closest to you Christians? If not, you need to be very careful which direction you're being pulled. And so close friendships that may pull us away from Christ, it is, in a sense, pitching our tent toward Sodom. A dating relationship where the spiritual leadership is absent is pitching our tent toward Sodom. And constant influence from people who don't love God is pitching our tent toward Sodom. And the New Testament does deal with the reality of that. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and within its context, he's dealing with Christians who are teaching that the resurrection is already past. And he says, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. And then he says, become righteously sober-minded and stop sinning. His point is, you can't play with fire and not get burned. Bad company will corrupt good morals. And notice he doesn't give an exception there. He doesn't say, if you don't pay careful attention, or if you're not strong enough, or any number of excuses that we want to throw on there, bad company corrupts good morals always. And so we want to make sure that we're guarding ourselves and not putting ourselves into situations where we're allowing other people to have poor influences on us. And I know what we want to say. I want to be a good influence on them. Well, take a cup of hot water and a cup of cold water and put it in a bowl together. What's going to happen? They're going to rub off on each other. You may warm the temperature of it, but they're going to bring the temperature down. And so we want to be very careful in the kind of relationships that we involve ourselves with, and not try to get too close to those who are going to pull us away from God. And then prioritizing career or work above spiritual focus. For some, money or success are the goal, and that focus can drift away from spiritual things. Because money is more important. My success is more important. We need to have the mindset that spiritual success is the most important. And physical success may come or it may not, but what I'm most concerned about is spiritual success. Some jobs may require unethical practices, and they may cause us to have to slowly compromise our morals. And in doing so, we are pitching our tent toward Sodom. And we could probably spend a lot more time. These are just a couple of things that we can do in pitching our tents toward Sodom. Things that we want to, decisions that we can make that can lead us to spiritual ruin. But I want to suggest, we talked about that decision that Lot made to pitch his tent toward Sodom was a decision of moral compromise. And I want to consider for just a few moments the danger of moral compromise. What we want to appreciate is sometimes the small decisions that we make can have huge or drastic, catastrophic consequences sometimes. And we can rationalize it, thinking, well, that's just not that big of a deal. And yet it ends up being some massive, big deal in our lives. Think Lot. First of all, it can damage our influence. Claiming to be a Christian and yet surrounding yourselves by things that are sinful, like going to the bar or drinking parties, and not drinking. Yeah, I'm going, but I'm not going to partake. Or I'm going to go to the dance, but I'm not going to dance. I'm going to put myself in the midst of the immorality, but I'm not going to partake of it. Or work leaders or parents doing unethical things when they preach ethics and how we need to be ethical people. All these things are damaging to my influence. And we can make all the excuses that we want in regard to many of those things, but the reality is Proverbs 6 and verse 27 says, "Can a man take fire into his bosom and not be burned?" You know the old saying, if you play with fire, you're going to get burned. And so we don't want to compromise or make compromises that will damage our ability to influence others for good and instead lead to us be influenced by unrighteousness. And so one of the things that I think we need to have in the forefront of our mind is that I am tasked by God Himself to shine my light to the world around me. Matthew 5 verse 16 tells us that. Let your light so shine before men that others can see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. But when I make moral compromising decisions, I'm hiding my light. And I'm making decisions that are not shining forth the light of Christ. There was a football coach several years ago, and I didn't know this until after the fact, but apparently he claimed to be a Christian, and yet it came out through various means that he had used the school cell phone to call escort services. And I remember some of the articles that were written, oh, he was nothing but a fraud. He loved to stand on his faith, but he's nothing but a fraud. That danger, that moral compromise, or that's not just compromise, that's just diving headfirst into sin, that damaged his influence. And we want to recognize that the people around us are watching. We may think nobody sees, nobody knows. People are watching, and they see what we're doing, and they see when we call ourselves Christians and we act in ways that are unbecoming of Christ, the world can see it. And they're rejoicing when they have opportunity to point the finger and say, see, hypocrite. We want to be like Daniel, where we're not giving them opportunity to say anything evil against us because we are faithful to the Lord in all things. And so we want to be careful that we're not damaging our influence. But then proximity will lead to participation. We can think, I can go and be around these ungodly people and that's not going to have an impact on me. That is a lie. That is a lie that the devil is telling you for you to think, I'm strong enough, I can handle it. Paul seems to think differently. Remember we saw that 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, evil company corrupts good habits. Paul didn't seem to think that you're strong enough and that you can handle it. He seemed to think that you need to guard yourself because proximity is going to lead to participation. If you place yourself in tempting situations or environments long enough, it will wear you down. There's a preacher, he used to preach down in Southern California, not too far from where I lived, actually where Kinsey and her family lived for a little while. And my dad and I went and visited him one time, and he had a pocket knife, and it was really funny. He pulled the blade out, and what would normally be a blade that thin was kind of half the width because he had ground it down so much. And so, the reality, that didn't happen overnight. He didn't just get one day at the grindstone and just grind it on down. Year after year after year after year of grinding it down, it wore it away until half of what was originally there was left. The point is, when we place ourselves into tempting environments, what we're doing is sin is grinding away at us. And we may think, I'm strong enough right now. Maybe now you are. But if you keep standing there, it's going to wear you down. It's going to grind away at you until eventually that strength that you thought was there is not there anymore. Proximity will lead to participation. And that's why we're called upon to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, Ephesians 5, but rather expose them. Don't get close to immorality and think that it's not going to have some kind of impact on you. It will. And along with this, I want to emphasize one thing, and that is there is no moral neutrality. We tend to look at situations and think that they're morally neutral. And that is a myth. There's absolutely nothing in this world that is morally neutral. We may look at the decision that Lot made and think, you know, it's morally neutral. You know, he maybe made some bad choices in with it, but you know, the decision to choose the valley was morally neutral. Well, ask his wife. That wasn't moral neutrality. Ask his daughters after they have committed this atrocity with him. That's not a neutral, morally neutral decision, was it? There was nothing neutral about it. And I think too often what we do when we're facing a situation, we kind of look at it, well, is this sinful or is it not? That's a good question to ask, right? That's not a bad question to ask, is this sinful? But if the only question we're asking ourselves is if this is sin, no. Okay, well then I'm free to just dive right on into it. Let's step back for a moment from that. There are things that may not be sinful and in a sense can be good, but they can still become destructive to us. You know, James uses that point in James chapter 3, beginning in verse 5. Where James says here, so also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. Behold, how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, the very world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our existence and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and birds and of reptiles and creatures of the sea is tamed but and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. What he's talking about is your mouth. You know that thing that God gave you to be able to communicate with others? And yet, James is saying the tongue, that our mouths are full of deadly poison and are a restless evil. And yet, we sit and think, well, what about the good things that we can do with our tongues? I can preach the gospel. I can encourage other people. I can do a lot of good things with my tongue. You're absolutely right. You can. But are you? Are you using your tongues for good, or are you using them for evil things? See, the point is, the tongue can be good and it can be bad. The choice is, the point is, what are you doing with it? It's not neutral. You're either actively doing what is right and what is good and speaking the things that are wholesome and godly and pure, or you're speaking the things that are unwholesome, ungodly, unrighteous. And this is, there's a whole lot of areas where we may apply this idea. But before we do that, I want to kind of illustrate this in one way. In the book, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the doctor, he creates this potion, and in this potion, he's able to transform. He's creating Hyde, Mr. Hyde. And really what he does is he creates this, I guess you could call it an alter ego or whatever it is supposed to be. And so Dr. Jekyll is able to go about his life and to maintain his good reputation, maintain his honor in the society. But then he can take this potion and he can transform into Hyde, and then he can indulge all the fantasies of the flesh, and nobody has to know it's Dr. Jekyll. Sounds great, right? Well, the problem is, after a while, after so many times of doing this, Mr. Hyde starts to take over. It would happen at first, he would take the potion and turn into Mr. Hyde. And then you start to see him wrestling eventually because he wakes up as Hyde. It starts to control him. It starts to overtake him. And so what seemed like a cool solution here was anything but, because it started to overtake him, to destroy him. And so there's many things in our lives that we tend to look at in morally neutral ways, like Dr. Hyde, or Dr. Jekyll. I can make this alter ego of myself and he can be the one to sin, and then I'll maintain all the goodness of my own character. There are areas in our lives that we can look at that same way. Social media, look at all the good we can do. Are you doing good with social media? Ask yourself that first and foremost. We can say all day long, think about all the good things that we can do. Yeah, but that does not include the death scroll when you're spending hours wasting your time scrolling on social media. Or you're looking at things that are unwholesome or ungodly, or again, going back to what we were already talking about, filling our hearts and minds with the immorality and the ungodliness that is so prevalent on there. Yes, you can do good on there, but we can also apply what James said. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. And we need to weigh, is it worth it? Is it worth exposing myself to all this evil for just a little bit of good that I can do? Because I think you can do tremendous good with it, but sometimes the evil outweighs the good. And it brings it to a point where it's not worth messing with. I think TikTok is one of those things. You may be able to do good with TikTok, I don't know, but that is the devil. Or come from it are full of evil. It's not worth many of those things. And so if we are going to involve ourselves in it, we need to make sure that we are guarding ourselves. That we're making sure that I'm actively keeping away from the things that are unrighteous and unwholesome and unholy, and I'm only doing that which is good. You think about sports. Children, our parents want to put their children into sports because they think about the teamwork and all the good things that they can learn from that. And the question is, yes, that's all well and good, but are they learning those things? Or are they watching the superstars on TV as they're showing all kinds of attitude and you know, all about me and selfishness? What lessons are we learning there? Are we learning the lessons that God wants us to learn, or are we then taking the lessons that we shouldn't be learning? Same thing with work. Work is a good thing. God has created us to work, but He's not created us to work to the neglect of other things, more important things. And so that is not morally neutral. I've heard of people, you hear stories all the time. In fact, there's even songs written about it, of men who have devoted their entire lives to their work and they've lost their families. And then their kids grow up and want nothing to do with them because they didn't have time for them. Now I don't have time for you. That's not a morally neutral decision. We can make even something as good and as honorable as work, it can take too big of a place in our lives. Then family and friends, that's a good thing. But if I have friends that are not leading me or encouraging me in the ways of righteousness, that is not morally neutral. And so we want to, first and foremost, recognize whether something is sin or not. And if it is sin, obviously we stay away from that. If it's not sin, is this going to lead me to a place that's away from God? Or is it going to lead me closer to Him? Is this going to help me to draw closer to the Lord and to be more loyal to Him in all of my life? Or is it something that's going to get in the way of that? That's part of Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2, where the author says that we are to lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. We may need to pull away those things that are not inherently sinful, but are drawing us back because it's not morally neutral. And as we apply that to Lot, Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom. He may have thought, well, we're not living there. Eventually he did. And look at the consequences that resulted. If we're not careful with the decisions that we make, and if we're not seeking heavenly wisdom in the decisions that we're making, those too can lead us to spiritual ruin. And then we want to consider the importance of boundaries. We might look at the decision of Lot and think that there's nothing inherently wrong with choosing the valley as long as he doesn't get too close to the wickedness. And I think there may be a case that could be made. If he tried to avoid and to keep away from Sodom and to teach his children, there's wickedness there and we're not going to go close to Sodom. We're going to take this valley, but we're going to be in this area where we're nowhere near that wickedness, then maybe you could make a case there. And the reality is there's a sense in which we cannot escape the wickedness in the world around us. I wish we could. I wish we could just have some commune of godly people where we could just be together and not have to deal with the unrighteousness. But then we wouldn't be the light to the world. But 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 9 says, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. I did not at all mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the greedy or in swindlers, or with idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world. He's saying you can't escape wicked people altogether, but you can choose your close associations. You can choose those that you allow into your inner circle. Have you ever talked to somebody and somebody asks, oh, is that a friend of yours? It's like, well, more like an acquaintance. I know them, but we're not really friends. We're not enemies either, but we're not, you know, they're an acquaintance. You know, we're friendly, we're on good terms, but we're not really friends. There are people that we do allow into that circle that we call friends. Who are we letting into that inner circle? People that are going to push us toward Christ and help us to be more loyal to God? Or are we going to pick those that are drawing us away, that are going to influence us in negative ways? While we can't be isolated from the world around us, we do want to insulate ourselves from the wickedness around us by placing proper boundaries. Boundaries can keep us from getting unnecessarily close to sin, creating as much distance between us and sin as possible. And I emphasize as possible, because there's times where you just can't avoid it. You go to the grocery store and you're going to see it all around you, and then the best you can do is just guard yourself there. But we want to create as much distance from ourselves and sin as possible. And putting it up there on the television screen and staring at it and watching it is not putting as much distance from it as possible. And then, boundaries help to protect our sensitivity, which is crucial for avoiding moral compromise. We want to maintain that sensitivity. And this is not on our screen, but you find in Jeremiah chapter 6. Jeremiah here writing to Israel, or Judah, whichever people it was, about some of the ways in which they have transgressed the will of God. And he says in verse 15, were they ashamed because of the abomination that they had done? They were not even ashamed at all. They did not even know how to feel dishonor. They didn't know how to blush, is what some of your versions say. We blush when we're embarrassed, right? When something that happens that is embarrassing or shameful, our face goes red. But what he's saying is they're committing abominations before God, and they forgot even how to blush. They don't even know how to feel the dishonor that's associated with the sin that they're partaking in. Boundaries, placing up those boundaries to keep us as far away from sin as possible, maintains our sensitivity to it so that we can recognize it for what it is and our conscience does not become seared. And boundaries will help prevent gradual entanglement. I want to suggest no alcoholic ever became an alcoholic at the first drink, or thought that he would become an alcoholic when he took that first sip. He never was tempted with it the first time and said, I'm going to be an alcoholic. But that's where the journey started. That's where it started, and it led him down the path to where he was overtaken by it. But if I set up that boundary in the first place where I'm not even going to go near it, then I'm not going to gradually become entangled by it. And whatever kind of addiction you want to throw in there is going to apply to that. And not even addictions, just habits that we form. Boundaries will help us prevent that gradual entanglement where sin becomes habitual. And boundaries will preserve our influence. When I stand on conviction and I don't allow my boundaries to be knocked down, then other people will be able to respect my influence because I've preserved my influence. They'll respect my consistency. They may not agree with the boundaries that I've set up, but they can at least respect the consistency of them. And then boundaries are about applying wisdom to our choices. Proverbs 4 and verse 23, guard your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life. I'm placing up a boundary because I'm trying to act wisely in every choice that I make. Because I'm not interested in pitching my tent towards Sodom. I'm pitching my tent towards heaven. That's where I want to go. That's where I want to be. And so I'm not going to be distracted by the glitz and glamour of Sodom or the well-watered plains of the valley. I'm going to keep my focus, my attention on higher ground, on the things that are eternal. And so if we want to avoid pitching our tents towards Sodom, watch out for the decisions that you're making. Beware of moral compromise. Recognize that there's no neutrality, and you have to be active in pursuing what is good, or else we can be susceptible to being overtaken by what is evil. And then always remember the blessing and importance of putting up boundaries to guard yourself from sin. And that will keep us from pitching our tent towards Sodom, but keeping our our path paved towards our heavenly home. I think we can see that Lot made a poor choice, and it brought about catastrophic consequences. What we want to do is recognize that every decision that we make can bring about major consequences, no matter how small we think they may be. No matter how insignificant of a decision we think it is. And you think about that alcoholic, that first sip, that may not seem like a big deal, but it brought disastrous consequences. And so we want to seek God's strength, God's guidance in all that we do so that we're not pitching our tents toward Sodom, but we're seeking our homeland. And we're only doing that which will draw us closer toward God so that we can dwell with Him after this life is over. And so if we can help you in any way in pitching your tent towards heaven and removing your tent from Sodom, we'd be glad to do that and to encourage you and to help you in any way that we can. If you need to obey the gospel to have your sins washed away so you can begin journeying towards heaven, we'd be glad to help you become part of the family of God. And if you are a child of God and you have pitched your tent towards Sodom, we can help encourage you to set your focus on higher things, on heavenly things, as we all seek together to set our focus upon heavenly things. Our Lord has provided us an invitation. We can come to Him broken down and empty so that He can fix us, that He can fill us. And if you're ready to come to Him just as you are, He will heal. Why not come now as we stand and sing together?